Thank you, Ellen, thank you, Melinda, and thanks to Cedar for the invitation to be with you today. I also acknowledge that we meet on the land of the Gadigal people in the Eora Nation and acknowledge Elders past, present and emerging. And of course, for all of us who are interested in economic policy, a key challenge of economic policy in our country is eradicating the scourge of Indigenous disadvantage in our nation. Well, again, thank you for the invitation. I've spoken at many Cedar events over the years and have tackled various issues. Last time I spoke, I think I talked about housing policy and the importance of reform in housing policy. I remember I first spoke about my views about the inequities of retirement income policy in Australia in relation to our working women and the unacceptable retirement income gap of Australia's women, which was a precursor of our announcement that we would pay superannuation in paid parental leave and abolish the low-paid threshold for non-payment of superannuation, which disproportionately disadvantages low-paid women. So there have been many opportunities over the years in various portfolios to discuss many issues. And I've generally tried to avoid partisan comments in my speeches at CEDAR, but given the federal election is almost inevitably less than 100 days away, there's no point in avoiding some plain talking this morning. And I'm sure you wouldn't want me to avoid some plain talking, and that might mean that I, in the course of the remarks, might make the odd partisan point here and there. Because this election will be very much focused on economic policy as well as other matters, and there is a clear choice in this election in May. We have been outlining very detailed, comprehensive economic plans, the most comprehensive economic agenda of any opposition in generations, certainly in 25 years, arguably in 40 years. We've been outlining our ambitions to do big things, to give Australia a proper energy policy and a climate change policy, to provide the framework for investment in energy generation, which is so necessary and frankly so lacking at the moment, to invest in a massive upgrade in skills formation, in human capital, from universal access to preschool for 3- and 4-year-olds, to lift us to international best practice, to better and fairer schools funding, to a massive investment in TAFE, and to reversing cuts in universities, to improve the revenue base of the budget, to close down and reform tax concessions, which we think are no longer fit for purpose, which are necessary to fund those important initiatives and investments, and also to provide bigger budget surpluses, a bigger buffer for the federal government in uncertain international economic times, to generate investment through tax relief on the condition of investment through our Australian Investment Guarantee, an upfront 20% tax depreciation schedule for all investments over $20,000. A step change in our economic engagement with the Indo-Pacific region, a massive focus on business and language literacy and policies to diversify and deepen our economic engagement with countries across the region. These are just some of the elements of the economic policy that I'll talk about today, and our agenda to ensure that our 27 years of uninterrupted economic growth are continued but also fairly shared across the country. Now, the government does have a different approach. Normally, the small target strategy is one embraced by the opposition of the day. Don't say very much and hope the voters don't notice a lack of policy agenda. But I'm going to put to you that actually it's the government which has engaged in the small target strategy in this occasion and have relied on the politics of fear as opposed to the politics of an agenda of policy. The government spent 5 years internally arguing about whether climate change is actually real, and they now go to the election with their only energy policy being a Venezuelan-style socialist big stick intervention, which will actually chill investment, provide uncertainty for investment, and put upward pressure on energy prices. They've also avoided making difficult decisions when it comes to the budget, instead assuming that global conditions will remain benign and that our terms of trade will remain around 40% above pre-mining boom levels. Now, today I will talk about the economic agenda of a shortened Labor government should we be elected. But I think it's also appropriate and useful for me to talk about what I see as some of the failings of the economic management that we're currently experiencing in order to give you a guide or an idea as to what would be our priorities in office, as well as talking about some of the policies that we would engage in. And I'll touch on employment, on wages growth, productivity and investment before talking in a little more detail about some of those policies that I outlined earlier. Now, of course, the government likes to talk about its job creation record. They talk about having created a million jobs, but in fact, of course, there are now fewer people employed full-time now as a percentage of the labour force than there were when they came to office in 2013. As a result, we are experiencing record high underemployment. 1.1 million Australians are underemployed today. Add this to the unemployed, and we have 1.8 million people, nearly 2 million people, who want more work. And the second point to make is where the jobs are actually coming from. The government, the Party of Free Enterprise, argues that their superior economic management has seen job creation. But in fact, a disproportionate amount of the jobs are being created by government investment, by publicly funded industries. Since 2013, almost half the jobs created have been in publicly funded, supported employment industries like health, education and public administration. That's not a bad thing, but we have to recognise that that's where the employment growth is coming from. Over 570,000 jobs were linked to these publicly supported areas of the economy. And in no small part, this has been due to one very important Labor initiative from our time in office, the National Disability Insurance Scheme. Some estimate that federal and state government NDIS rollout, when it's complete, will have added 163,000 full-time jobs to the economy, which is more than the general structural uplift in job creation in the health sector. And finally, of course, we need to, when considering our job creation record over the last 6 years, compare it with our international counterparts to see how we've been doing. As you know, we got through the global financial crisis, the most difficult economic circumstances in 80 years, with a better unemployment rate than the United States, United Kingdom or New Zealand. Now, we don't. We've gone from being world beaters to laggards in international terms. And against this backdrop, the government announced recently that they would generate 1.25 million jobs over the next 5 years. Sounds impressive. However, it's also inconsistent with the government's own budget figures, as the Treasury confirmed its estimates 2 days ago. And it also is actually entirely lacking in ambition. The 1.25 million employment growth, if it was achieved, would be consistent with the annual jobs growth of around 1.9%, which is exactly the historical long-term average in Australia. So actually, it's just keeping in line with historic trends. Now, of course, one of the impacts of this underperforming labour market, one of the consequences has been record low wages growth. Now, this is causing real concern in the community. When the Prime Minister and Treasurer say their economic plan is working, there are many working Australians who say it is not working for me. And that is a very understandable point of view. The Prime Minister, the then Treasurer, declared 18 months ago, and I quote, "There are reasons now to be hopeful that we near the end of this adjustment process and consumers will start to see their real wages growing in line with productivity again." They haven't. The fact is that wages forecasts have been downgraded in every one of the budgets of the Abbott-Turnbull-Morrison government, and they will be downgraded again in the April budget. The anemic wages growth is feeding into stagnant living standards. Increased living standards is, after all, the holy grail objective of economic policy. But we've been failing. Recent data released by the Australian National University shows that for households, living standards, that is household income less household costs, declined by 2.9% over the last 3 years. That is the largest fall in living standards in 30 years. Now, of course, we've known for some time that people aren't seeing much of an increase in their pay packets. At the same time, cost of living, particularly in relation to electricity, private health insurance and childcare, is very substantial. Real wages, measured by the real value of compensation of employees per hour, has increased by a touch over 1% over the last 5 years. This compares to a 9% increase using the same measure occurring between 2008 and 2013. This means that the real value of compensation accruing to Australian workers increased seven times faster under the previous Labor government than under the current government. Now, of course, I fully recognise that this is not an entirely Australian phenomenon. It is an international phenomenon. But even taking that into account, we are not doing as well as we should. Recent wage growth in Australia has been worse than the average experienced in the OECD. In fact, between 2013 and 2017, Australia ranked 27 out of the 35 OECD countries when it comes to wages growth. This follows the period prior to 2013 under the previous Labor government where wages were growing faster than the OECD average. So yes, this is a developed country challenge, but we are not doing as well at it as our competitors and comparators. The government's policy, the only wages policy, has been to see penalty rates cut for those workers on Sunday, the first arbitrary non-negotiated wage cut in Australia in 80 years. Now, of course, I think we would all agree that better wages growth would be better for all, not just wage earners, better for the economy, as the Reserve Bank has said. Governor Philip Lowe said, the best outcome is one in which a pickup in wages growth is accompanied by stronger growth in labour productivity. That's because ultimately the basis of sustained growth in real wages is that we become more productive. Of course, I couldn't agree more. The best result would be an increase in productivity and an increase in wages growth to match it. But in recent years, there's been a disconnect between how productive Australian workers have been versus how they've received their compensation. We haven't been growing productivity fast enough, and employees have not been adequately receiving compensation for the increased productivity that we have had. We need to lift productivity and ensure that these gains in productivity are shared with the employees who help generate them. There's been no discernible increase in labour productivity as measured by GDP per hour worked over the last 2 years. None. In fact, 7 of the 9 last quarters of labour productivity have been negative. And this is disappointing, but perhaps it's not entirely surprising. Productivity growth, as we all know, comes about at the enterprise level, but is also generated by national reform, economic reform, which has been the hallmark of Labor governments of Australian governments of both persuasions over the last 30 years. But I have to say to you, over the last 6 years, the reform effort has been largely non-existent. The government junked the Australia and Asian Century White Paper that was initiated by the previous government. But even reform efforts instigated by this government have not come to fruition. The government instigated a tax white paper, which was junked between the draft consultations phase and release. There was a proposed Federation white paper, which actually never saw the light of day. We had the Productivity Commission report, a good report, which the opposition endorsed, called Shifting the Dial, delivered in October 2017 about lifting national productivity. It lies unloved and apparently unlamented by the government. I'm going to put to you that we cannot afford more of this policy drift. We cannot afford more of this stop-start reform agenda. That's why we've taken the approach of seeking a mandate to do big and important things. As I said, we do go to the election with a very comprehensive policy program. It has some political risk to it. But we do so because for reform to be successful, a government must have the moral authority of a mandate. A government should have been brave enough to share with the Australian people our thoughts about the reform challenge and opportunity in Australia and ask the Australian people to cast judgment on them. And that's exactly what we're doing, seeking a mandate and seeking the moral authority that goes with that mandate if we receive it in less than 100 days to say to the Parliament through the Senate and the people, we've been honest about our plans and now we seek to implement them. Now, I'll talk about some of that reform agenda, our agenda to reform what I see as the shortcomings of economic management over the last 6 years. Far from shirking the task of increasing national productivity, a shortened Labor government would embrace it, improving the quality of our human and physical capital, encouraging technological innovation and making our cities work better and engaging in the world and particularly our region. Productivity is not always about cutting protections for workers and cutting the social safety net, cutting penalty rates and wages. At the heart of our productivity plan is investment. I want to touch on a few areas of our investment. Of course, part of it is our Australian investment guarantee that I refer to, our 20% upfront depreciation. Now, importantly, this would apply to investment in new intangibles, knowledge-based assets, as well as traditional physical investments. We would have bigger and better tax cuts for all Australians who earn less than $120,000 a year. But also we would provide tax relief to businesses on the condition of investment. Companies small, medium and large making new investments would be able to immediately deduct 20% of the cost in the first year over and above the existing depreciation schedule. The current government does not support that, so that is a key difference as we go to the election. Now, the 20% upfront deduction would not just apply to traditional investments like machinery and equipment, although it would, but also to the depreciation of increasingly important intangible assets. This means investments in patents, intellectual property, and upgrading computer software, all supported under the Australian Investment Guarantee. Now, we all know that that's of increasing importance. The Grattan Institute has pointed out that investment in intellectual property products rose from around 7% of measured private non-mining business investment to 21% between 1990 and 2016. Supporting intangibles is increasingly important because of the rise of the digital economy and e-commerce, which are less capital intensive and more human capital intensive. And this is something we should all care about because we are currently a laggard in OECD terms when it comes to digital innovation. Alpha Beta, the consultancy firm, has pointed out the productivity gain from technology in our economy has been below that of our peers, and we've not managed to build our own digital industries at the same scale. If Australia can catch up with its peers, it would unlock $315 billion in economic value over the next decade. So when it comes to investing in new, tangible and intangible assets, we need it to shift in the policy settings, and a Labor government would. Now I want to turn to skills, which is such an important part of our economic agenda. Again, I'm going to quote the Governor of the Reserve Bank, who said, "Our national comparative advantage will increasingly be built on the quality of our ideas and our human capital," something I think we could all endorse. In a rapidly changing jobs market, skills that allow young people to be enterprising so that they can navigate complex careers across a range of industries and professions is, of course, becoming increasingly important. Problem solving, financial literacy, digital literacy, teamwork and communication are different from the technical skills which are specific to a particular task and which our education system currently concentrates. Now, I could talk about our school funding plans. I could talk about our very significant investment in TAFE and vocational education and training. I could talk about our plans in universities. But today, in the time available, I want to concentrate on one particular area of our investment in skills and in human capital: early childhood education. As it stands, nearly one in four children start school in Australia without the foundational skills necessary to be successful learners. Almost a quarter of young Australians in 2019 start school without the necessary foundational learnings. We know, we don't think, we know that these children are twice as likely not to meet NAPLAN standards in years 3, 5, and 7. And it's not just traditional areas of pre-numeracy or pre-literacy that are important. Just as important are the social and emotional skills that children can learn with qualified early educators. Studies have pointed out that the years before children start school is the period when children learn to communicate, get along with others, control and adapt their behaviour, emotions and thinking. Now that is exactly why an incoming Labor government will provide for universal access to preschool for every Australian 3- and 4-year-old. No matter what their background, they will access 2 years of world-class early learning. Now, currently, we do have a national policy of universal access for 4-year-olds. That runs out at the end of the year. It's unfunded after December this year, and current government policy is to end the funding. We won't end the funding, and we will expand it to 3-year-olds as well. This will bring us into line with international best practice. This is an important reform. Bill Shorten calls it the most significant investment in early childhood education in Australian history, and he's right, and will deliver it. Now, finally, I just want to turn to an area which I believe deserves much more attention in our political debate and will receive much more attention under a Shorten Labor government: Asia relevant capabilities. Growing Australia's Asia relevant capabilities should not and cannot start at university, but ideally much earlier in life. And I say to you frankly, as a country, I'm not making a political point, but as a country, our performance is lamentable. There is no bright spot. Let's talk about languages as an example of how we're doing. Whether it be Japanese or Hindi, Indonesian or Cantonese or Mandarin, we are doing really, really poorly. Indicative of the perilous situation is that more Australians studied Bahasa Indonesia in school in 1972 than do in 2019, despite the fact, of course, that our school population is many multiples bigger. Indonesia is going to be the fourth largest economy in the world by 2050, and we are simply not bothering to learn the language or engage with the country. If we don't turn this around, it will have adverse implications for our economy and for business wanting to expand in our region. ANZ's most recent Asia survey made it clear that for businesses potentially looking to enter Asian markets, And I quote, "The biggest barriers indicated are lack of knowledge and limited language capabilities for developing business relationships." Now, we've announced a range of important initiatives here under our Future Asia framework, putting in place a nationwide Asia Capable Schools program that will help drive sustained whole of school change in assisting and supporting 5,000 school principals and school leaders to better understand the economic forces at play in the Indo-Pacific region and what kind of workforce the country needs and that they need to prepare their students for. Establishing an advisory council on Asian capabilities that will be headed up by experts from academia, the education sector, business and not-for-profits to drive research and generate new ideas to boost teaching and learning about Asia across all levels of our education system. Offering 100 scholarships a year for native language speakers in Australia and top performers in priority Asian languages in year 12 to get teaching qualifications to become Asian language teachers in schools, because we have a massive shortfall if we're going to turn this problem around. Investing an extra $8 million in community language schools, which we announced just last weekend, so that more Australians get the chance to learn other languages in non-school time. Now, this will require a sustained effort. This is a big cruise ship to turn around. We are so far behind, and it won't be easy, but we're committed. And I've, some would say courageously, committed that as Treasurer, I would report annually to Parliament on progress in achieving these aims, so that the government has an accountability mechanism that we'll be held to if we're not making enough progress. So in conclusion, as we do head to this election in less than 100 days' time, there will be a battle about whose plans are better for the economy. The government's had 6 years to lay out a plan. They haven't done so. 6 years to tackle the big issues confronting the nation, whether it's producing a coherent climate change and energy policy, getting productivity and wages going again, or making the big calls on the budget. 6 years to engage in a proper comprehensive plan on Asian capabilities. Even its performance on jobs, as I've put forward before, doesn't stand the test of scrutiny in relation to international achievements. We've been doing average. We need to do much better than average in Australia if we're going to keep the 27 years of uninterrupted economic growth going. We can't be a free rider on a healthy global economy. The healthy global economy might not be there. We need reform. We need unity in government. We need consistency of purpose. These are all things that we think we offer in the Shorten Labor team. We'll go to the election as a united team, having spent 6 years in opposition almost, developing the plans for the country that we think the country needs, developing the policy formulation and the tough decisions that are necessary to seek a mandate to do big and important things. It'll be up to the Australian people to decide. They'll decide in a few weeks' time. We look forward to the contest, and if we're so blessed, look forward to implementing the mandate we achieve at the election. Thank you very much.